Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 91. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, DTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. And if I can figure out how to do it, I'm going to be putting my podcast also up on libertarianinstitute.org. This will be the first time, so I'm probably going to have technical difficulties, but you should be able to get that on there, this being Wednesday, later today, or tomorrow morning. I want to remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom, 31-Day Guide to Waking Up to Liberty. Check it out on Amazon. It's available for Kindle. My new book will be out very soon. I'm done with it. I'm just doing some editing, and somebody is writing a foreword for me. So I'm trying to have it out by April 1st. I will let you all know the date it'll drop on Amazon. Today, I invited Keith Knight on. He is the host of the Don't Tread on Anyone podcast. Well, I call it a podcast, but he really does mostly Google Hangout live streams through YouTube, something that I've never done, and I'm impressed by people who can do it. I don't think anyone wants to see my ugly mug, so I don't do it. Keith and I are going to talk about just a bunch of stuff. We're going to bring up topics from current events and put our libertarian and our anarchist and voluntarist spin on it. I'm also going to talk about some great interviews that Keith's done recently with Scott Horton, Larkin Rose, and Walter Block. So I'll let him plug at the end, and I'm going to try and get some things down, get some links down in the show notes to some archives that he's put together. So without any further delay, here is Keith. So what's going on today, Keith, man? How you doing?
I'm doing excellent, man. Thanks so much for having me on your program. I swear, your book, Freedom Through Memedom, is so good. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, thanks. Well, I mean, you had me on when the book first came out. You were the first show I ever went on to advertise it. So, and I mean, you had nothing but nice things to say. You left a great review on Amazon, man. I appreciate it, and you know, wanted to have you on to talk about all the great things that you've been doing. So I know I've seen a couple interviews of yours lately, and I must say the one you did with Scott Horton, maybe the best interview that I've seen of him, basically explaining the things in his book and explaining the history of, you know, Afghanistan and the Middle East. Hey, I've had him on a couple times, and I think you went even further.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, you know, it's impossible to talk about anything that Scott Horton does without 50 other things coming to mind, because so much is connected. But that's what that's how the political elites are able to make you think about an event incorrectly. So they'll just say, look, 9/11, and as Harry Brown says, to think they hate us for our freedom, you'd have to say history started September 11th, 2001. So Scott Horton has such an intellectual treasure chest of knowledge regarding the history of people, of events, going back to Operation Cyclone 1979, the CIA training the Mujahideen, going back, I mean, you can go to the Balfour Declaration of 1917 or the founding of Zionism to really understand U.S. foreign policy, the Oded Yanan plan, a plan for Israel in the 1980s. There's so much to get into that I decided to bring up the Lusitania and Pearl Harbor even. So, yeah, I had a great time with Scott.
Yeah, I recently had Jeremy Hammond on, and we spoke for 2 hours. He went 2 hours and 5 minutes talking about his book, Obstacle to Peace, the U.S.'s, you know, what the U.S. is doing, how the U.S. interferes with Israeli policy. And I've had people tell me that they listened to that, they listened to that episode a couple times. And, you know, it's very interesting that people like Scott are finally bringing out the truth of what's going on in the Middle East, because I believe most people just believe what the New York Times says and what the Washington Post says and what they read on the evening news and what they see on the evening news and read in the paper. But so much truth is out there. I mean, even, you know, there are Israeli newspapers that are publishing the actual truth, and it just gets ignored in this country, and you have to, and people have to go looking for it. So, you know, people like Scott Horton are just, they're educating us. It's, It's amazing.
And the great thing about increases in the ability or decreases in the cost of production make it so someone like you can publish a book. So, for instance, on page 74 of your book, you have a picture of the Lusitania, the Gulf of Tonkin, the babies in incubators, and Iraq WMDs, meaning that the entire New York Times, these articles, these books written in one image, you're able to convey the message of showing a historical pattern, not to mention Operation Northwoods, the sinking of the Maine, and everything else. But we're able to compete with them on a much greater level now, and that's what that's really where I think the future is. Who can best use new technologies to convince people of their philosophies?
Well, if I want to learn anything about what's going on, you know, this announcement a couple weeks ago of Russia having these missiles that can do things that, you know, you have to wonder if this is even true. If this isn't Russia putting out propaganda that they have a missile that can go around the South Pole and come all the way back up. You know, but if I want to learn about that, I don't go to the Washington Post. I don't go to the New York Times. I go to antiwar.com or Libertarian Institute, because they're going to have information. They're going to be sourcing information from places that the New York Times and Washington Post are purposely ignoring.
Sure. Yeah. I love antiwar.com. No others come to mind immediately, but I mean, Tom Woods has a great speech on U.S. foreign policy. Robert Higgs has Crisis and Leviathan. And getting that historical knowledge is so important when you're facing new issues. I mean, if someone says North Korea has nukes, therefore they're a threat. The Soviet Union was like 50 North Koreas, and that was able to end without nuclear destruction. So the idea that Kim Jong-un is a threat to national security, I think, is total baloney.
Well, you also have to worry. You also have to wonder what's going on in D.C., okay? Trump fires Rex Tillerson, puts the head of the CIA in charge as the chief diplomat of the United States. He replaces the CIA head with a woman who ran a torture site. And basically, we have proof that Pompeo and what is this lady's name? I can't remember what her name is. Halsey something. We have proof that she, you know, She's run a torture site. We know this. So basically, war criminals are being put in place at high levels, which is not draining the swamp. And then he's surrounded by Marine Corps generals. His chief of staff is a Marine Corps general. His Secretary of Defense is a Marine Corps general. What's on the horizon?
It's a very unique way of draining the swamp. This is 43D chess, not to be confused with 42 and 41. Of course, this is an absolute sham. Trump comes out wanting his tweet the other day said, "Bump stocks soon out." What is that? That is such status mythology talk, like as if they're going to physically disappear. No, what he means is the state will now have a legal monopoly on bump stocks and 100 other pieces of artillery, 18-inch shotguns that was illegal when sold to Randy Weaver, because the state needs a monopoly on those. Very interesting way of keeping us safe. Now, the Trump phenomenon is very important. You have someone so radically different in appearance, in talk, and we are sort of getting the same thing. Now, people are more afraid of Trump today than they were 10 years ago when Trump was in the predatory private sector, billionaire out for profit, which indicates that the leftist status idea of without government, the rich will take over. No, just the opposite. If we have a person who's bad, it's worse for them to be in government than for them to be in the voluntary sector. John D. Rockefeller is another great example. He can't make a dime unless he produced oil that people benefited from and voluntarily traded their money to get, whereas he and his children later used foundations to infiltrate government to use the public education system. So, again, we see a perfect example of rich guy who we're supposed to fear, and that's why we need a state to protect us from. The reality is using the state is what is the great danger to the freedoms that we treasure so much.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about – I mean, I remember – I'm old enough to remember when the left used to be anti-war. Well, that's usually only when a Republican is in office. But they concentrate on the wrong things. It's my belief that they don't want that the reason they hate Trump so much is because he's a Neanderthal. It's because he's not the cool guy like Obama or even the hokey kind of aw shucks, you know, kind of George W. Bush. No, he's a guy who hires hookers and fucks porn stars, and they're so married to the government, it's their whole identity, that they can't have daddy out there embarrassing themselves. Where what they really should be concentrating on is that this guy's being run by people who think that war is an inevitability. And some who think that war, that nuclear war, is an inevitability. So, yeah, I just dismiss leftists. They can't even figure out what's the most important thing.
Well, this is a very difficult time for them. The new high priest of their religion of statism is not someone who they like to brag about, as they have for the last 8 years. I mean, literally, we're dealing with a religious belief that 10 years ago, Trump could just write words on paper and they'd mean nothing. But now when writing words on paper, they're executive orders and laws of the land. I mean, this is, as Larkin Rose perfectly calls it, the most dangerous superstition. Literally, FDR writes down on paper, put Japanese in internment camps, and they do it. Confiscate the nation's gold, and people do it. This is incredible what we're up against and how easy it is to refute. I mean, the left's claim that that great meme that I've seen you post is Obama crying when he sees a gun in someone's on someone's hip, and then him laughing at a drone. I mean, if you think this is anything but emotional manipulation, so the state can monopolize the masculine defense power in society, I gotta say you need to rethink your position.
I had something on my mind, and then you said meme, and of course I went off on it. My mind went off somewhere else. But the you mentioned Larkin Rose. Let's get off this depressing stuff. You interviewed Larkin Rose too recently, and I hadn't seen him being interviewed by pretty much anyone in a while. So how'd you hook that up?
Okay, so Larkin Rose had a Facebook post that was titled Rent a Ranter, where he says for $60 he'll give you 30 minutes of his time on any platform, and then $40 for every additional 30 minutes. So I just sent him the money and asked for a request, and we had a Google Hangout, and I thought the most productive use of our time would be discussing how to talk to statists, because there was another post that he had that was like, to be pretty damn blunt, anarchists and voluntarists sometimes care more about winning petty debates than they do about changing the minds of the masses. And I'm like, God, I do that all the time without even realizing it. I'll get sucked into the what private defense organizations will do if A, B, and C happens and D doesn't work. So I wanted to say every minute of this discussion is going to be valuable. And then I just listed my bullet points, and we ended up going for a pretty long time. I think we had an excellent discussion again. The two great things that I learned from the Candles in the Dark seminar that I attended in Phoenix that Larkin Rose and Ernie Hancock set up was you can't force someone to accept an idea. You can get them to say the words, fine, I'm an anarchist. Now leave me alone. But that's not them accepting the idea. You can only invite them to do so by planting the seed of truth. And that was something huge that I just thought was so terrific. A couple of the images we go over in the handout that he gives is it shows one person yelling at another when the reality is the average statist is not the enemy. The enemy is this irrational, superstitious idea of the state that they have in their head. So by simply using their own logic, you can come to the logical conclusion that anarchism is the only legitimate, moral, economically efficient way of running society. And then another image we go over is it shows three groups of people, everyone else, law enforcers, and lawmakers. What he is trying to communicate is for not people – today people see these three groups as three groups having three different types of rights. The reality, the moral way to approach it, would be just to see human beings, no one having any more rights than the other, therefore a world without rulers. Not rules, rulers. So we go over those things, and I ask him a bunch of questions. We even do a role play of how to communicate to status. We open up with the role play. So I thought that was a really productive conversation, and I'd ask people to check that out, share it, cut up the video, download it, re-upload it under another name. It's for everyone. No IP.
Well, now tell me about my go-to guy. When anybody asks me about privatization, is Walter Block. I look for, you know, I go to Mises and I search Block and I look for anything, you know, privatizing roads, privatizing borders, whatever. And you had a chance to talk to Walter too, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I had read like 170 articles by Walter Block over the last 5 or 6 years, and I got them all into an archive, archive.org, Walter Block, The Ultimate Collection, I titled it, and I sent that to him and said, hey, I've put all your work together if you want to share this. These are my favorite works of yours. By the way, can I get an interview? And we had a really good discussion. We talked about his book, Defending the Undefendable, which is basically starting with the libertarian premise that individuals own themselves simply because they have the greatest claim to their body, having the only direct influence on it. Therefore, any aggression initiated by others is criminal and a violation of self-ownership and the non-aggression principle. The only two ways to acquire property legitimately is through voluntary trade or original appropriation. And with that premise, he comes to all these conclusions and makes excellent arguments for them that are basically social taboos. For example, the pimp, the prostitute, the employer of child labor, people who sell tickets, illegal helpers, people who charge interest on money known as usurers. So he really gives some great economic arguments for freedom, whereas the average person might say, yeah, freedom's good, but these things are so bad we need a state to stamp them out. He says, first of all, that's immoral. Second of all, here are the utilitarian benefits that these people provide to society as a whole, should not be seen as people acting immorally, but should actually be seen as people who are meeting consumer demand voluntarily. And that's why I think that book was so important. And, you know, I asked him a few things about Murray Rothbard, what he loved about him. And he said, you know, that Murray was just always so happy. He of course, plugged Murray's books and his work, but contrary to what Nick Sarwark said when I saw him at a dinner, Nick Sarwark said, contra Rothbard, you can't just hate the state, you have to love freedom, which I don't think is an accurate portrayal of Rothbard at all. Both Walter Block and Jeffrey Tucker, who knew Rothbard very well, said the one thing they learned from Murray is he just loved life, loved freedom, and just was full of joy so much. And that's why it's great to talk to people like Jeff Tucker and Walter Block.
The person who says that Murray Rothbard did not love freedom, has never read Murray Rothbard. I mean, how do you read For a New Liberty? How do you read Anatomy of the State? How do you read Man, Economy and State? And come to the fact that he, you know, not, you know, overwhelmingly hated the state over loving freedom. I mean, first of all, they both go hand in hand. Now, if you choose a specialty and your specialty is, you know, like, you know, Scott has foreign policy, and if your specialty is to, you know, just attack the state, pretty much like I did in my book, it's hard. You can't make the judgment on someone that they don't love freedom. If they're out there saying that the state needs to go, there's a reason why, and normally it isn't because, you know, because they don't love freedom. Normally it's the opposite. So that doesn't make any sense to me. And honestly, he doesn't sound bright. He sounds like somebody who has a talking point ready at any moment. And that's pretty sad. That sounds like a politician to me.
Yeah, that was very disappointing to hear him grill Rothbard or fight with Tom Woods or anything like that. I just feel like it's overall very unproductive. I thought Sarwark did a good job in his Glenn Beck interview. Generally, I think it was like 10 minutes. You can find it on YouTube. So I'm not a total anti-Sarwark. I really just see the potential benefits that people have. Stefan Molyneux is a terrific example. He wrote a book, Everyday Anarchy and Practical Anarchy, which are two of the most amazing pieces of work I've ever read. He's made terrific videos, but now he's condoning so much of what Trump does. But don't focus on the person. It's more important to focus on their work and the benefits you can get from spreading those words.
Speaking of somebody who's gotten out there into the zeitgeist in the last few years, you were telling me that you had a chance to, you went to some kind of seminar that Mark Passio did?
So, yeah, this weekend in Phoenix, Arizona, there was the Truth, Mind, and Reality Conference set up by a guy named Ivan Oyola. And the people that were speaking at the conference were Lennon Honor, Mark Devlin, and the headliner was Mark Passio. And as an organizer, I got to meet Passio sort of off the stage and stuff, but Mark Passio was such a cool guy to meet. I hope to interview him soon because he has such a great mind and so much material. He gave, maybe it's biased towards me because I was physically there for the presentation, but I think it might be his best presentation to date. It's called Duress, Dissidence, and Deadly Force. Again, he starts with no assumed knowledge, hardly any assumed knowledge, starts with self-ownership, talks about statism and anarchism being the one true divide. And then, well, before I get to that, that is a really important thing. Statism and anarchism being the one true divide among human beings. There's so much of this Democrat, Republican, black, white, gender. I mean, dear God, the feminist. Men are spreading their legs. Men interrupt too often. Men take too long to explain things. They interrupt more often than they do other men. It's so trivial. Here's the one divide that we need to focus on. People who advocate initiating violence and people who advocate the non-aggression principle. That in and of itself is such an important message that he goes through in his talk. Then he talks about historical cases of dissidents. He talks about Frederick Douglass. He talks about the American revolutionaries. He talks about things like the Haitian Revolution, a lot of historical examples of people who not only said no, but forcibly resisted people who initiated violence against them. I think it's a very, very important talk that is on my channel if people are interested.
Cool. So what, do you mind getting into a little more about what he talked about? Does he mention like the term natural rights, or does he just talk more about self-ownership from a philosophical standpoint?
He talks about natural law and property rights. saying that the only rights are property rights. It's so hard for me to pick up. I should have had my notes on me.
Oh, that's cool.
So, he has a whole 9-hour presentation called Natural Law, which is not that long considering we spent 6 hours a day, 5 days a week for 12 years in government schools. You can watch his thing in 2 days. He really gets into what is a right. And a right, which he says, which I would modify just a little, he says, a right is an action that a human being performs that does not cause harm to another human. I would say aggression instead of harm, because harm is a little more vague, but he has a great defense for all this stuff. So Mark Passio's work is very important to keep an eye on.
Cool. So what do you... I know you've probably been paying attention after the Parkland shooting, and I make this point in my new book, and I want to see if you see what you think of this. I make the point that the people that we see a lot of leftism coming out of college students because of, you know, their professors and you know, who... You know, these Marxist professors, you know, I guess after they go through college, there's nowhere for them to go into the free market. So, you know, in the market, so they just stay in academia or go to a think tank. So I've seen over, like, you know, we've definitely seen over the past decade that college students are, you know, talking more about socialism. They say that 44% of millennials endorse socialism now. The thing that I mentioned in my new book about this whole thing in Parkland is now they're using high school students, and it, to a certain extent, some people might listen to a college student or someone college age, you know, someone in their early 20s, and take them seriously. Why am I the only person in the world who's listening to high school students and going, why the fuck should I be listening to anything you have to say? I remember when I was in high school and no one should have been listening to my opinion at all.
Well, I'm not that far off from high school. I'm only 22, so I hope people don't have that idea too much. But the important thing is to listen to anyone, old, young, foreigner, you know, domestic citizen, and analyze their arguments accordingly. So I'm totally open to listening to David Hogg. The thing is, everything out of his mouth is complete bullshit. So that's the reason I don't advocate anything he does, not because of his age. You made an interesting point about the liaison between the state and intellectuals. In Anatomy of the State, Rothbard goes into this great. He goes, it's pretty clear that the state needs intellectuals to propagate the social contract, why the state's necessary economically, why it's morally legitimate. But why do intellectuals need the state? To which he says, the average person not being that interested in you know, complex ideas about the world, they see the state as secure sources of income for them and the future. So there is this sort of unholy alliance between the state and intellectuals. The intellectuals will then emotionally manipulate you with young children. Don't you care about the children? Actually, I care more about the children than you violent advocating assholes do. So when I see Madeleine Albright say, yeah, 500,000 civilian deaths, many being children, that's totally cool. I have just as much sympathy for the children of the regimes of Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao, Hitler, than I do for the children of Parkland. I have an equal amount. The state or the gun control advocate, on the other hand, only cares about some private murders sometimes when it can be used to their advantage. So you have a great image on page 50, on day 28 of your book Freedom Through Meandom, where it goes, Trump is literally Hitler. We have to resist. Other button, ban guns so only the government has them. Proud liberal sweating, trying to choose between the two. Yeah, there's first of all no intellectual consistency. Second of all, it's completely manipulative to say child believes X, therefore X is inherently legitimate. Don't you care about the children? It's a total non sequitur.
Well, it's also the fact that you can listen to them talk. And I'm sorry, they're reading from a script. They have video footage of him being helped, where he's talking, and the producer is stopping it because he's forgetting his lines, and they're feeding them to him. So
I've seen that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this isn't a conspiracy theory. Freaking go on YouTube, you can watch it. You know, he's saying, "Oh, I'm sorry," you know, and then they. And then the other one they want to concentrate on is some one that, look, you know, it could be a female, it could be a male. And Vin Armani points it out that on the first day that they brought her out there, I think her name is Emma Gonzalez, she kept playing with her, she kept rubbing her head like she was playing, like her hair was still there. And as someone who shaves his head, and as Vin shaves his head, you know, he points it out that if you've been shaving your head for any time, you don't play with it. You don't put your hand on your head unless you have an itch. So it's like they shaved her head for this moment. Yeah, it's like they prepared her so that she could speak as a androgynous, as an androgynous figure to, you have one white guy, you know, one white guy who's speaking to white people, David Hogg, and then you have this androgynous Hispanic who can speak to everyone else. And, you know, it's just so, it's so staged. And I said, you know, and my comment is not to be conspiratorial about it, is it's almost like they had this set up in the event that something like this would happen again. They had like all these little groups, these people taking pictures in Virginia and Michigan and you know, all these little groups that managed to spring up that no one had ever heard of before, but they managed to spring up in the span of 48 hours. It's just, very odd.
The interesting thing about propaganda is that by its very nature, while it's happening, it's hard to decipher, but later on is almost laughed at as that is so obviously propaganda. For example, we look at World War I, World War II posters, and we go, well, people saw that and were motivated to think one way or another. Now, today, it's very hard to decipher because we don't know what MKUltra methods the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and the executive branch are using. So this is why it's so important to have a philosophical understanding of natural rights, property rights, and human interaction. So when there's a shooting, we don't get caught up in arguing about the technicalities of false flag, legitimate, how did he or she get the gun, could this have been avoided, well, it's because of that state, because of this law, because of this politician, because of this drug that he was on. There's so many technicalities to distract you from the rights that people have. And the question is, does a group of people, in this case the state, have the right to coercively confiscate guns from the populace in order to hold a legal monopoly on AR-15s or any other gun, but the AR-15 is in question here? And the answer is unequivocally no. Just use it with – just instead of the state, use any other group. Hey, leftists, I think the Koch brothers should have a monopoly on guns, but every 4 years you get to vote for someone in the Koch Foundation to represent you. They would laugh at me at how stupid that joke is. The unfortunate thing is they see government as a special group with special rights. because they have they're part of a superstitious religion called sadism. So this Parkland nonsense, the Vegas shooting, Columbine, all those are those stories are used to distract us from having an understanding of principles. You sometimes just have to get uncomfortable and ask people this question. What happens if I don't turn my guns in? What do you think should happen to me? Now, I'm not going to tell you what answers I've gotten because I've gotten things all over the place, or ask them, why does the state have a right to monopolize certain weaponry? Have there been historical examples of governments committing atrocities? Sometimes you have to ask that question to them just to see where they are intellectually, to see who you're dealing with. That is part of the planting of the seed that is so important for us to do on our end.
Well, I don't know if you saw that my last podcast was entitled An Anarchist Explains the Second Amendment. And in that podcast, I unironically make an argument that I should be able and everyone should be able to own nuclear devices. My whole argument was, if I'm going to be truly free, if I'm going to possess liberty, then I have to be able to be on a level playing field with the biggest guy on the block. And I should be able to own drones and fighter jets and all those things. So I don't really do, I understand what you're saying. And, you know, asking questions like that is really important. Asking them to commies doesn't really work out well because they want to put you in gulags. But the, just today, I mean, before we even started, someone was making this argument online about how, you don't care about kids if you don't want background checks. My go-to lately has been that, some of the most victimized people in this country are minorities. You know, in black neighborhoods, black on black crime is awful. Why are you making it? Why do you want to make it harder for those people to be able to protect themselves? Why do you want to make it harder for women who are physically weaker than men? Why do you want to make it harder for them to protect themselves? And that's kind of hard to argue against, because how do you deal with that, especially if you're a liberal and you're supposed to be for, you know, these phantom women's rights, you know, like women don't have the same rights as men, or, you're supposed to care for the minority, as Ayn Rand put so perfectly, that, you know, the individual is the smallest minority. So if you're not for the individual, then you don't really care about minorities. So that's something that I've been throwing back at them, recently, which I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, I live in Georgia, very large black population, and my assumption is that we all have guns. And that's why I try to be chill. That's why I try to be cool. And when I go to the range, there's, people of Asian descent on one lane, and there's black people on the next lane, and there's Hispanic people, and we're all just there shooting. And I think that scares them a little bit, that minorities would want to be able to take responsibility for themselves, because then they don't have to go running to daddy government so much.
Well, of course, the minority play, just like the we care about children play, is simply a method to propagate their ideas. I mean, Lyndon B. Johnson famously said, according to a book titled Inside the White House, that I'll have those niggers voting Democrat the next 200 years. I mean, these people care about minorities. Harry Truman was a Klansman. Robert Byrd was a Klansman. There's, of course, no intellectual consistency, especially for the libertarian minority in this country. Why isn't that minority ever talked about by politicians as someone who need to get their voices heard, someone we need to listen to and respect? I mean,
because we're all billionaires who are hoarding gold. Didn't you? Haven't you gotten the message on social media?
Well, just consider the implications of that. They care more about the color of skin minority than they do content of character minorities. I mean, just throw that in their face and see what they say. It's so inconsistent that the average person doesn't know what they're talking about. But when it gets to the level of all the politicians promoting the mythical wage gap, saying we care about minorities, the government cares about minorities, give me a freaking break, that you have to come to the conclusion that they are using manipulation methods, not having an honest conversation. And that's very different. And how you approach that conversation is very different from someone who genuinely cares and wants to have their voice heard, wants to hear your voice. They will put you in a cage for not chipping in for the welfare state and the warfare state and shoot you if you resist. You think they care about you. You're out of your freaking mind. To the leftists, I'll say, you know what? Fine, I concede. Trump is a racist, fascist, misogynist, Islamophobic, anti-Hispanic, Nazi. Now, I don't want him to have all the guns. That's why. Maybe you have to talk on that level. It's not through pure logic you can convince some people, but you can just say, you know what, even if Bernie, the sacred Bernie, gets to be high priest of this religion of statism, I still don't want the state to monopolize AR-15s because a Trump-like can get in there. Right. And that's very important. The fact that they can't understand that after 12 years of government indoctrination just shows you that what the hell are they talking about 6 hours a day for 12 years, 5 days a week?
Hey, check this out. I don't know if you've had this conversation before, but Republicans like tariffs again.
Well, tariff is a $20 word for taxes, which is a $40 word for theft. If you don't think tariff is an economic regulation, if you don't think outlawing mergers is an economic regulation, I really don't know how to talk to you. It's so unbelievable.
You know, anyone can go and go to Mises.org and download Economics in One Lesson PDF EPUB for free. They can turn to, I believe it's chapter 11, and they can read, I think it's 9 pages on tariffs. By the third page, you will figure out why tariffs. I mean, basically, the same argument against tariffs is the same is the same thing as the broken window fallacy. If we're getting it from somewhere else now, and we're paying $10 less, that $10 can be spent into another industry and can create jobs. But if you stop it, if now something that costs $20 now costs $30 and you don't have access to the $20 product anymore, that $10 that you could spend somewhere else isn't going anywhere else. It's the same thing, you know, it's the same thing with the broken window, which is in chapter one or chapter two. I think it's chapter two, but they don't get it. It's, oh, we're losing a trade war. Oh, they're charging us well, France charges us a tariff for this. No, they don't. They don't charge us a tariff. They're charging their citizens, you know, a tax on it. Yeah. And when you turn it around like that, it's a perfect example of why economics is not taught in high school and why it's not required in college. They want you to be stupid. They want you to have feels about it. They want you to be emotional about it. And if somebody tries to talk to you and explain it to you, I mean, you realize free traders now, if you're promoting free trade, you're a globalist.
Yeah, that was a great meme you had today where Anarchy Ball is reading Basic Economics and Communist Ball is reading Advanced Feelings.
That's an old meme that Ball put out so long ago, and I found it in my phone, and I was like, oh, man, I love this one. It's got to go up.
But it's so perfect. Oh, so, all right, so let's approach it from the economic, then the principled position. So Walter Block, in his book Defending the Undefendable, has a chapter called Defending the Importer, and he talks about how, let's just apply their logic consistently and then ours. So their logic, trade between nations hurts jobs. Well, doesn't trade between states? How about trade between cities? How about trade between different streets of people? Aren't you giving someone else a job you could potentially do? What about the individual? Shouldn't people only make their own stuff? Which is ironic because they often give the anarchist the, oh, you just want everyone doing their own thing. You don't believe in cooperation. No, we don't believe in violence. We're not against cooperation. So their approach logically leads to only individuals doing it themselves. Now, the libertarian position, the freedom position, is, well, if that's consistent, you believe that if we find species on other planets, we should trade with them? Absolutely. Imagine the freedoms, the new ideas that we would have, not just between cities, states, countries, and nations, but even planets. Of course, I'm not saying that, but that is a way that they could apply our logic consistently. So, yeah, our logic consistently works. Their logic consistently falls back into the tyrannical primitivism. Now, the principled approach, the most important, again, because in the debate today, they'll use things like, this is Joe. Joe lost his job because of a job being shipped to X, and give you all this emotional nonsense, and they'll say, well, it's different with aluminum and steel because these products, and then they'll go on and on. No, it's not different. The principle is, do two individuals have the right to trade voluntarily without a coercive third party entering into the trade agreement? The answer is no. Whether it's between streets, cities, states, countries, or continents, no third party has the right to claim ownership over a transaction if by doing so they are claiming ownership over all the property in the world and ownership over the two individuals engaged in the trade. Imagine if I said, Mance, every time you trade with someone, you have to give me a dollar. It's not exactly tyrannical. It's not exact. Well, it is tyrannical, but it's not ruining your life. And it's just a tariff. But do I have the right to do so? The answer is no. What if I say vote between me and my best friend to decide who's going to initiate tariff violence against you? And if you don't pay us that fee, we're going to put you in a cage and shoot you if you resist. The principled approach just refutes this garbage again and again and again, making it ridiculous for us to have this conversation. I mean, economically, in 1776, Adam Smith gave great arguments for free trade, and then David Ricardo after him just blew every anti-free trade argument out of the water. And today, Don Boudreau and Walter Block make the best free trade arguments you could ever come across. And it's funny, after hearing Don Boudreau, the economist, make all these economic arguments for free trade, he goes, now, he spends like 10 minutes making these arguments, and then he goes, and now, by the way, that's not why I support free trade. I support free trade because it's moral. Two individuals have the right to trade their property voluntarily at any price for any reason without a third party initiating violence into the situation. It's that simple.
Well, I trade on a pretty regular basis with this entity called Kroger. They're a grocery store. I think that our trades are fair. I give them green pieces of paper, which one day may not really be worth anything, and I get back food and products that I need to live, things that are sustaining me. You know what's the one thing that I don't like about our trade? There's a third party, and that third party is charging me extra money, and neither Kroger Kroger doesn't get it, and I don't get to keep it. And that is sales tax. That, I mean, the trade would be so much more fair without the sales tax. And I think I always get the better of the trade. Like I said, you know, these green pieces of paper may not be worth anything down the line. But, you know, tariffs are basically just like, or like the sales tax that we get to, that we get fleeced out of when we go to buy something. It's like the property tax. It's like any tax.
And moreover, you have a massive trade deficit with Kroger. All the money you've ever spent there to zero is the deficit between you and Kroger. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. But when they throw this term at you, the trade deficit between country X and country Y equals this. It's like, what are you really saying? I have $1,000 deficit with my car, with the people who I brought my car from. That's not a bad thing. I got a car in return, but they don't see the dollar sign on the other side of the equation because the other side is in the form of a good. So when they say Steve Jobs is a guy who just got billions of dollars, well, he only acquired those billions of dollars by giving people in return something that they valued more than the money they paid for it, or else they wouldn't have made the trade in the first place and continuously bought his products long after he was gone while they're being innovated more and more every 9 months or so. So, yeah, every one of their arguments from a principled approach, from a consistent approach, is absolutely ridiculous. And it's very sad to see the people who are, we're pro-gun, while Obama's in office, are like, well, Trump can ban bump stocks. We're anti-economic regulation. Well, this regulation's for in the best interest of the collective. Unfreaking believable.
Well, Sheldon Richman made a really good point. He was Horton had him on the other day. And he talked about how steel, there is a steel industry in this country. People don't realize it. The problem is the thing with it is, and it's not a problem, it's technology, is it's almost fully automated. They don't, you know, it doesn't require humans to do the job anymore. And, you know, here's one that I've been getting from, you know, people who obviously got their economics degree on 4chan or something. China's selling us steel, mind you, about 5% of the steel that comes into the United States comes from China, and they use slave labor. Really? You don't think that they're using automation as well? Where do you think the automation's coming from? And then Canada and Mexico are, you know, probably the where we get the majority of steel from, and they're exempt from the tariffs, at least for now, he says.
Yeah, so NATO countries are exempt. What a coincidence. Yeah. Well, just look at Matt Zwolinski has a great essay on sweatshops. Now, the sweatshops did not begin in China. Obviously, Mao would not let any free enterprise in some time ago. But they started in Japan. Then they left and went to Taiwan, then Vietnam. Now they're in China. Why did they leave instead of just keep on using that slave labor? The reason is because the country became so much more advanced because of this economic industrialization over time, just as the U.S. had horrible working conditions in the 1800s. Conditions improved as the result of an increase in access to advanced technologies, advanced machinery, making workers more productive, increasing the standard of living. So capitalism is like this success bomb that just goes off in one country, moves to another, goes off, increases the standard of living radically in another. So let's say that there is slave labor in China, and that's what you call it. Wouldn't it be that much more important to trade with those groups, making them wealthier now and in the future, so that slave labor becomes obsolete? You think Congress writing down words on paper, outlawing trade improves the living conditions of those people, you're out of your mind. The great Mao's Great Leap Forward was already tried. Why don't we give capitalism a try? It's lifted a billion people in the last 50 years out of poverty in Asia between China, India, Vietnam, South Korea, and Taiwan. So, yeah, let's keep doing free trade, raising the standard of living. If you really care about the Chinese and the people in the sweatshops, let them be free. Let them trade with the capitalists around the world.
Yeah. In my new book, I bring up Chile, and I compare Chile and Venezuela. And, well, you know, Chile went through reforms, and they knocked the tariffs down to 10%. And they still tried to keep a control on the value of their currency. And there was still inflation. There was still hyperinflation. Finally, when they released all of that, when they said, screw it, no more tariffs, you know, we're going to let the currency be organic, you know, as much as they can. You know, a government has to be in everything. But now, even to this day, Chile, out of all the countries in the Americas, is the number one country in economic freedom, and more people are being pulled out of poverty in those in Chile than at every year. And then you compare that to Venezuela, where we're gonna let the people, you know. Who even knows what that when Chavez took over, you know? And I researched this, and I'm so confused on exactly what he thought he was doing. But then you have an oil rich country, you know, maybe the largest oil reserves on the planet, and because they didn't adopt economic freedom, everybody moved, all of the money moved out. No one puts money in there. And now people are eating zoo animals.
It's so interesting. Milton Friedman, a long time ago, said, if government was put in charge of the desert, there'd be a shortage of sand within a decade. Now, it's not that funny, because Venezuela, having as much oil as they do, are literally experiencing more shortages than a place like Chile. So there was some great insight into that reductio ad absurdum from 50 years ago that Friedman made. Just look at those examples. Look at the example of America versus the Soviet Union, the example of North Korea versus South Korea, the example of East Germany versus West Germany. I mean, it gets a little ridiculous after you keep looking at the examples. And if the socialists really cared about the poor, they'd be capitalists. After all this time, maybe when Marx was writing in 1848, it's still nonsense, but I could have more sympathy in 1848 or whenever it was written, long ass time ago, before the Industrial Revolution,
exactly.
The technological advances. Maybe I'd have more sympathy, but today it's like you're a frickin' Google away. You have this Google machine in your pocket that you carry around with you so you could tweet about how evil capitalism is, and you can't understand the difference between capitalism, the private property ethic, and socialism, the institutionalized aggression against private property. You can't make that connection with why one consistently creates more wealth than the other. I have little to no sympathy for you, and you're not taking my guns, P.S.
It's collectivism, man. You even see it on the right now. You know, there are, I say all the time, collectivism is cancer. And you'll see people who are on the right. I mean, Donald Trump fans, if you can, you know, if people are 100% in line with his policies, I have a hard time putting them on the historic right. But, you know, they'll say, no, man, no. I mean, they're so tribal, you know, that they hear something like the phrase trade deficit. And, you know, I told one person, I said, look at the three countries that are on the top of the trade deficit list and the three countries that are on the bottom, and tell me which of those six countries you would want to live in right now. And it's the ones that are getting, you know, the ones that people who are uneducated would look at and go, oh man, the United States has the worst trade deficit. and so does Great Britain. And it's like, well, I would pick those countries over China, who's on the top of the list, any day. You know, so it's, I mean, was it Mises or Hayek? If they understood economics, they wouldn't be socialists.
I'm not sure, but I do know Rand said that disasters at this level of magnitude are not the result of chance. In other words, we are up against people who are immoral, openly advocating immorality. I mean, Paul freaking Krugman, that he has to be the most dishonest person that's alive today. He simply cannot address mainstream arguments leveled at him to the point where it's just obvious. I mean, you can't actually think that Trump and cops are racists and should have all the guns. There's no way. There's no way you've sat down and thought about that.
Well, then either you haven't thought about it, or you're being dishonest and you don't actually believe that cops and Trump are racist. I mean, there's no either one. But I wanted to bring this up. Did you see the Ben Shapiro tweet where he was like, where he said, like, only if there was somebody who had written a novel about corporatism in the steel industry, and he had a picture of Ayn Rand.
No, I did not see that.
Yeah, it was one of the better. It was one of the better tweets of the last month. I was like, oh man, why didn't I think of that crap? You know, damn it, man.
Yeah, you know, Rand's work is so valuable. I mean, something I bring up a lot of times with feminists is that, I mean, Ayn Rand escaped the Soviet Union after her father's business was collectivized by the evil Bolshevik bastards, comes to America, learns a different language working a shit job in Hollywood, only to write the two most influential books of all time, second and third only to the Bible. Considering the Bible had a bit of a head start, I'm going to not count that as a fair competitor. But the fact that she's not seen as an absolute hero shows me feminism is absolutely co-opted, not to mention Gloria Steinem and the CIA, not to mention feminists never talk about gun rights, or they say my body, my choice, but they won't say my purse, my choice, or anything like that, obviously, because feminism, just like the left uses blacks, Hispanics, minorities, and children, they attempt to use women as a total voting block, just as the Soviets said, the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. In America, they're using the man versus the woman, the black versus the white, to create this illusion of a divide that really is not there. Eric July tweeted out a long time ago something about white people. How have your black interactions gone today, yesterday, the last week, or something to that extent? And you realize that there's no genuine animosity between the two. Whereas if you just watch CNN, it's this predatory white versus the black. It's the predatory male versus the female. The reality, back to the one true divide, some people believe in peace and voluntarism. Another group believes in violence. That's the real divide we need to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading recently that a lot more people are starting to believe that the reason for the civil rights movement in the 60s, one of the big influences on it was how the Soviets used to use the way the United States, and especially the government and the police forces, were treating black people as propaganda. You know, saying, oh, they're saying they're so much more civilized than we are, but look at the way, you know, they're sicking dogs. They're sicking dogs on black people. And, yeah, they actually used that as propaganda. And a lot of people have come to believe that that was a big influence on LBJ and the civil rights movement, was that a lot of his people, a lot of the deep state kind of guys back then came and said, look, they're winning the propaganda war on this one. We need to do something.
Oh, yeah. Well, the rulers have so much more in common with each other than they do with their subjects. So when people say, we are the government, I absolutely have to laugh. They're constantly using each other's methods, finding out what works over here, what works over there. The Soviets looked at how the Kennedy assassination was covered up, and the KGB came to the conclusion that the head conspirator was Lyndon B. Johnson, as did the French intelligence. So countries are always looking at each other to find ways of how to manipulate each other. After Brexit, they had said this was the result of Russian hacking. You can find that on the BBC, same thing. Everything that Trudeau uses in Canada is frickin' verbatim what Obama was using. Just as Trump and Bush will use safety, national security, best interests of the country, the people, we have an obligation. They're constantly trying to manipulate the subjects with different methods of propaganda, and it's a big hero to fall when people say civil rights was great progress. Yes, I'm glad that there has been an elevated level of equality between blacks and whites, but it's also important to understand the motives. It's nice of me to give you a sandwich, but if you find out my goal is to poison you over time, that too is also important to recognize.
Hey, I want to we're going over an hour here, so if you don't mind, I'm going to cut it. And is there anything you want to plug? I mean, talk about your YouTube channel, because it is blowing up. So,
well, my great achievement was finally finishing reading each chapter of The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose. I believe that is the most important book that's out there on the topic. It's so consistent. The arguments are so logical. If you could check out that playlist on my channel, Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. I'm on YouTube. I'm starting a Minds account. Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone is my Minds account. And on archive.org, I'm Keith Knight 13. If I could ask one thing of anarchist to watch, it would be my interview with Larkin Rose called Government is Immoral, Larkin Rose and Keith Knight. The thing I would ask them to share, if they could do me this favor, it took me like 20 hours to make this whole thing. If they could share that playlist, The Most Dangerous Superstition, I'd appreciate it so much.
Cool. I will definitely put that in the show notes and try to make it linkable in even on the podcast channels. So, man, it's really good to talk to you. I'll probably talk to you soon, because it's probably going to be a couple of weeks, and I'm going to be putting the publish button. I'm going to be punching the publish button on another book. So, it's got to get it out there and tell as many people as possible about it, because I've actually, the cover's done, the book's done. I'm just editing now. The cover's done. The last thing was the title, and then I nailed down someone to write the foreword for me.
Please tell me it was Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's hilarious, dude. That's a funny fucking line. I mean, anybody who's listening to this who's not, I mean, that's such an inside joke. It's so hilarious. No, it's definitely not Hans Hermann Hoppe, but it'll be someone you know and like, I promise you. So, but
well, hey, man, your last book got you on the Tom Woods show.
Yeah,
I mean, I know. What the hell?
I know.
That was so freaking cool.
And I'll tell you, man, he hit me with some questions that I, you know, that made me think,
oh, yeah.
Made me think about what I wrote. And
Tom said something interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
yeah,
I know I'll forget this. Tom said something interesting in a speech. He goes, you know, I really love books that I learn something on each new page. So when Tom promotes something or talks about something, I know that he has the idea of, okay, if this goes bad, I won't publish it because I'm not going to waste my time. Also, I want to protect my reputation. So when he's interviewing people, he makes it productive. He doesn't do these – and whenever he does do a softball, he introduces it as, well, I got to throw a softball at you, so here it comes. Get ready. I mean, Tom is so genuine and so great that I was so happy to see that you were on his show, and I listened to it, and I loved it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, he asked me a couple questions that I had to that I felt like I was going off on tangents, and he asked me one question that I could have answered in two sentences and shut it down, and then I was like, as soon as I shut up, I'm like, oh, crap. It came to me. As soon as I shut up and he asked the next question, that's when it came to me. I'm like, oh, man, I got to be a little quicker on my feet, you know? What was crazy, though, is by the time I had done his show, I hadn't looked at the book in a while. So, you know, when you write something, even a short book like that, there was already stuff that I had forgotten that I had written. You know, cause, you know, you have this period of time where it takes you to write the book, then you go over and you edit it, and then it takes time to get it out. And then, you know, it was like, you know, another couple months later is when I got on the show and he brought something up and I was like, what the hell? Oh my God. I can't remember this. I was like, holy crap. that's why before I'm publishing this book, I'm reading this book like five or six times so that I can, I actually went over it twice yesterday, so yeah, I'm not going to get caught out there like that again because I've already got I've already got like one scheduled show to advertise it on. So I think it'll be fun. I think this one will be fun because this one will be something that the masses. It's more something that I think a lot of people can get into. I think my first book was very directed at a certain audience. I honestly believe that anyone could read anyone, statists, anyone could read this book and they'll get a lot out of it. And that the information that I give is, you know, in six chapters is really going to open people's eyes, who, you know, haven't been paying attention, don't pay attention like we do.
Well, and your first book, yes, it's towards, the cover's black and yellow, obviously. We know who the audience is. But consider the difference between your book and For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard and the difference between The Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital by Marx. To this day, I go down to Arizona State University and the Students for a Democratic Society have a copy of the manifesto on the table that they're getting people to sign up for copies of. Now, because it's so short, it's so blatantly in your face, is why it's successful. This is a great competitor to that. It's playing on the, here's my position, unapologetically, and it's short and sweet. Whereas it's a lot harder to hand someone Human Action or a Theory of Capitalism and Socialism. I'd love them to read that, but at the same time, how much are we going to ask of someone who thinks that all we are people who hate roads and pavements? So,
right.
So your book is so freaking important in that way.
And the new book is going to be a lot like that. In the preface, in the second paragraph of the preface, I write that this, my goal, my target audience when I wrote this was for mid-teens to late teens getting ready to go to college because they have to be prepared for what they're in for. They have to be prepared for what is going to hit them head on. And I used the word a couple times in the book, they have to be inoculated against it. And that's the purpose of this book is, and I mean, anyone can read it. The whole book isn't monosyllabic. I mean, I want to show that I actually do have a vocabulary. Anyone could read it, anybody of any age, but it was, my goal is if you have a kid that's thinking about going to college or is going to college, give them this fucking book so that they know exactly what they're going to be coming up against.
Well, in the same way you need physical self-defense mechanisms, just in case you need to defend yourself against people initiating violence, you need an intellectual self-defense in your mind against people attempting to manipulate you through logical fallacies, errors in reasoning, and non sequiturs. A great book on that is The Use and Abuse of Logic, How to Win Every Argument by Madsen Preery, the head of the Ayn Rand Institute. Just lists 100 logical fallacies, goes through them, gives analogies, gives examples, explains the principal error in reasoning. This stuff is so important for us to get out that really the difference between us and the statist is we've applied logic consistently. Not, well, because of the Industrial Revolution, X, Y, and Z happened. No, it's because, just as H.L. Mencken said in the beginning of your book, the most dangerous man to any government is the man who's able to think things out for himself.
What was the name of that book again? Because I'm embarrassed to say I don't know it.
It's called How to Win Every Argument, The Use and Abuse of Logic by Madsen Preery. That, The Most Dangerous Superstition, and For a New Liberty are the books that I just can't recommend enough.
Okay. Yeah, I just found it here. I appreciate that. Thank you. Well, I'm going to say goodbye. And, well, actually, I'll say till the next time because I know we'll probably talk pretty soon. So, man, just enjoy. I appreciate this. I know you're three hours behind me, so I know it was a little early. But I always enjoy talking to you. I want everybody to know who's listening to this. Keith is a fountain of knowledge. For being 22 years, I wish when I was 22 years old, I wish I would have had this kind of liberty education that you have. And I know you did it all yourself, so you know, I just want to say bravo.
I appreciate that so much, man. Thank you for having me on.
All right, and I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. I want to thank you for tuning in to episode 91 of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Keith for coming on today. Remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom. Check it out on Amazon. I have a really good interview lined up for tomorrow that I'm going to put out for the weekend. You guys are going to want to listen to this. This is going to be one of those subjects that might just rustle some jimmies that I'm going to get a lot of comments. I am looking forward to having Jeremy Hammond back on. If you remember Jeremy from episode 85, where he talked about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he's going to come on to talk about something that will probably be a little more controversial. So I look forward to putting that out on the weekend. You guys have a great week. Take care. Bye.